Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. Delighted, as always, to be talking to the best audience in the world in this broad arena of psychiatry, psychology, mental health. And I also want to say something I don't say often enough, which is how glad I am for PRN-FM and for the wonderful engineer that I get to work with, and for the wonderful producer I get to work with, and just for Gary Null for putting this on, keeping this station going. I'm going to now go directly to my guest without a daily or weekly update, because my guest today is one of the most important, honorable researchers in this entire field today. Let me check and see if we're connected. Irving Kirsch, are you there?
I'm here, Peter.
Oh, and the connection is good. Irving Kirsch, K-I-R-S-C-H, easy to find on the internet. He's associate director of the Program in Placebo Studies. And I'm going to leave it to him to explain to you how he got to be in that unique place, director of the Program in Placebo Studies, or as I would say, a specialist in psychiatric fakery. He's a lecturer in medicine at the Harvard Medical School. I'll repeat that one. Lecturer in medicine at the Harvard Medical School and the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's professor emeritus at a number of places, including the University of Plymouth in the UK. Lots of books, 250 or more articles and book chapters, many of them on placebo effects, but not just that. Antidepressant medicine, hypnosis, suggestion, and also the broader field, philosophy of psychology, psychotherapy. I mean, clearly this won't be the only time in the near future that I have him on, now that we've established a radio talk show relationship. He is the author of The Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth. The Emperor's New Clothes, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth. It's been published in English, French, Japanese, Italian, Turkish, and Polish. And this book and some of his articles, but I think it was mainly the coming out of the book, I'm not sure, he'll have to tell us, because he came out also with a kind of earth-shaking article, resulted in a 60 Minutes segment and CBS, and a five-page story in Newsweek, and that in this day and age, with the power of the drug companies, that a researcher could have that impact on the media is astonishing indeed. So welcome, Irving Kirsch, to the show. I'm so glad you're on.
Thank you for having me on, Peter. It's a pleasure.
I'd want you to take off wherever you want on all of these issues.
Well, where to begin? That's always
the problem. You can start with The Emperor's New Drugs, if you like, because that's your latest book.
Yeah, and that's a book that I wrote after having published with colleagues a meta-analysis of the trials that had been sent to the FDA for drug approval for what at that time were the six most widely prescribed medications. That's when there had been some coverage of previous meta-analysis I did on antidepressants in a number of media outlets, New York Times, Newsweek, and so on. But it really hit the fan when the 2008 meta-analysis came out. Shortly after that, I did a debate at Maudsley Hospital in the UK And in the audience, there was an editor for Random House. I didn't know that. Dan Hines is his name. He was one of the people in the audience listening to it. And he got in touch with me immediately afterwards, and he said, you know, I'd like you to do a book for us. And that's what led to me doing the book. I started writing fast and furiously and got it out and finished writing it in about 7 or 8 months, something like that, and was published shortly thereafter.
Well, tell folks about this meta-analysis. I'm very familiar with it, but it's really good to talk about people exactly what you did and what it showed.
Sure. This is actually the third meta-analysis that I did on antidepressants. Let me go back to the very first one, which is a study that the graduate student of mine and I, Guy Saperstein, and I published in at that time online journal sponsored by the American Psychological Association. This is going to be their flagship online journal. And what we had set out to do was not to look at antidepressants. I didn't have any particular interest in antidepressants, except at that time, not knowing what I've since learned, when I was, as a clinical psychologist, seeing clients in psychotherapy, and sometimes with very depressed people, I would recommend them seeing a psychiatric colleague for prescription of antidepressants while continuing the work in psychotherapy. And I was assumed, as most people did in those days, just about everybody, that they must work. So I would send people, and wouldn't do that now, but that's what I did then. And sometimes people would get better fairly soon. Sometimes they wouldn't. And I assumed that when they got better, that it was because of the drug which was helping, was working for them. And so I had no reason to assume otherwise. So I learned otherwise soon thereafter, soon after 1997, I guess, I first saw the data on it. And what led me to undertake this first meta-analysis was, as I said, not to examine the efficacy of antidepressants, but to look at the placebo effect. I've been studying the placebo effect for my entire academic life. I've just gotten interested in it as an undergraduate psychology major. It's a passion that has never left me. A lot of my research had been on placebo effects and related concepts, how expectancies can be interacting with treatments, and how they can help they can cause harm when they're negative expectancies, but cause benefit when they're positive expectancies. And it occurred to Guy Saperstein and to me that there ought to be a good-sized placebo effect in the treatment of depression. Should be a good-sized drug effect. We had no reason to question that, but there should also be a good-sized placebo effect. And the reason for that is that one of the core features of depression seems to be a sense of hopelessness. And one of the things that people can feel hopeless about is ever getting out of this terrible situation, this terrible state that they're in, ever getting out of the depression. And what you have the promise of a new treatment, which is what you're doing when you use the placebo in the clinical trial, that promise of something that might work would counter hopelessness. It should counter hopelessness. And so there should be a good-sized placebo effect. And what we wanted to do was look at, could we document a placebo effect? Now, it's not enough in doing that to look at people randomized to a placebo arm and seeing whether they get better. Because, well, you think about someone who has a cold. Let's say you're suffering from a cold, and I give you a placebo, and I wait 3 weeks. it'll look like something that might be used at a placebo effect. Well, of course not. Because if I hadn't given you the placebo, you would have been better 3 weeks later anyway. So that's what we might call a placebo response, whereas the placebo effect is the difference between what happens when you take the placebo and what happens when you do nothing at all. And so what we did was we scanned the literature looking for studies in which patients had been assigned to randomized to receive placebos, and studies in which people had been randomized to no treatment at all, to be in a natural history or a waitlist groups. So we're going to look for the difference between those two. Now, to find those studies, and finding those studies, the only place that you find studies in which people are randomized to get a placebo, depressed patients, are in antidepressant trials. And so when we are coding the data, of course, we had the antidepressant data as well. And so we analyzed those data as well. And we did, and we looked at, and we did this comparison. We had data on patients randomized to antidepressant, patients randomized to psychotherapy, patients randomized to placebo, and patients either just followed naturalistically or put on a wait list. And we found there was a big placebo effect. About 25% of the response to antidepressant drugs would have happened anyway, even if you hadn't given a placebo, but about 75% of that response is what you saw in the placebo group. So in other words, 50% of the response to antidepressants was a true placebo effect. 25% was natural history, regression to the mean, things that would happen even if a placebo hadn't been given. And here was my first real surprise. That meant that only 25% of the response to the antidepressant drug was a drug effect. It was a small difference. And that's what got me interested then in looking at what I now see as the inefficacy of antidepressant drugs. And we published those data. I was familiar with Peter Kramer's book, Listening to Prozac. So we titled our meta-analysis, Listening to Prozac but Hearing Placebo. And as you might imagine, it got a reasonable amount of press attention. It also created controversy. And there were critics of it. And the basic criticism back then was, you couldn't be right. This couldn't be the case. We know these drugs work. You didn't sample the right studies. There are many more studies out there that weren't included in your meta-analysis. The effect is really larger than what you have shown. So at that point, we wanted to see if that was right. And what we figured we'd do, this was a suggestion from one of the authors of our next meta-analysis, Tom Moore. I'd never met him before. He got in touch with me and said, I've seen the controversy, and I have an idea as to what you might do to resolve it. Why don't you see if you can replicate your own findings with a completely different data set? And I got a suggestion of what you could use as a data set. Why not use the Freedom of Information Act and go to the FDA and get from them the data that the drug company sent to them in the process of getting their medications approved. And I said, well, that's a great idea. He was in Washington, D.C., and I said, Tom, why don't we collaborate on this? why don't you go to the FDA to get the data and send us the data. And I was at the University of Connecticut at that time, send it up to Connecticut, and we'll analyze it here and see what we find. And you can do some analyses there and make sure that we're getting reliable results. And he did that. He got the FDA files, statistical reviews, medical reviews, on what at that time were the six most widely prescribed antidepressants. And we did the analysis, and what we found was that, in fact, the difference between drug and antidepressants was much smaller than what we had found in our first meta-analysis. Not larger, but smaller. And the reason for that, we learned, was that close to half, about 40% of the trials sponsored by the drug companies on what has then become their products were never published. So we had only had access to the published data, and now we had the unpublished data as well as the published data, and we analyzed all of those trials. We found that 82% of the response in the drug arms of the trials, 82% of that response was found as a response in placebo arms. That meant the difference between drug and placebo was only 12% of the drug, or 18% of the drug response. And we have now the same scale. All of these trials use the Hamilton Depression Inventory. Now that's a couple of versions on it of it, but basically the one that was used in those were a 17-item scale that could range from 0 to 53 points. And the drug-placebo difference was less than 2 points on the Hamilton scale. It's a meaningless difference in anybody's life. It's a tiny, tiny difference. And even commentators in the FDA files, FDA personnel, people who were involved in approving the drugs, noted in the files how small these differences are, how small they were in those clinical trials. So we published those data, another meta-analysis. And again, there were criticisms. And one of the criticisms was that the patients in these trials weren't depressed enough, that they were probably just mildly or moderately depressed. And maybe you don't see much of an effect in people that aren't that depressed, but really very depressed people that come into clinical practice, the typical depressed patient in psychiatric practice, with those people, if you had them in the trial, then you'd see a bigger effect. And that's what led to our third meta-analysis, in which we went back to the same data we had used for the second one, the FDA data set. We went back and we looked at how severely depressed were these patients. And what we found out was that there was only one trial with moderately depressed patients. That was a trial of fluoxetine, Prozac, in which there was no difference at all between drug and placebo. All of the rest of the trials were done on people who would be regarded as severely or very severely depressed. I take that back. They were all done on patients who would be regarded as very severely depressed. There weren't any trials on people where the average baseline score was in the severely depressed category. It was always in the very severely depressed category. And it was in those trials that we found this small, clinically meaningless difference between drug and placebo. And we published those data in 2008 And that's when the media picked up on it very quickly. The morning that it came out, it was a lead front page story in almost all of the major daily newspapers in the United Kingdom. It kept getting media attention. As you mentioned, it was in a cover story in Newsweek, a five-page cover story, and my book came out, and then there was a 60 Minutes segment, and people are still writing about it. The controversy continues. I understand that Peter Kramer has come out just now with a new book in which he takes me to task. I debated him recently, but I haven't had a chance to read the book yet because it just came out, so that would be fun.
That's a great story, and I guess it ends with psychiatrists and physicians have stopped prescribing antidepressants. That would be the normal outcome in a sane society of this kind of crushing data. I imagine, have you looked at a curve of antidepressant drug use in relation to your three studies and your book?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to have made a dent. Not only has there not been a decrease, but prescription rates have been going up. Now, it has made a dent in a couple of ways. Immediately after the 2008 study, there was a poll of British MDs, and a majority of them said that they would now take a second look at their prescribing practices. So that happened. Then there's an organization in the UK called the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. Their acronym is NICE, N-I-C-E, and so I always think of them as a nice organization. After our first meta-analysis was published, they changed their guidelines, not just on the basis of our data. They did their own meta-analysis and found the same very small difference that we had found, and they changed their guidelines for the treatment of depression, suggesting that antidepressants not be a first-line treatment for moderate levels of depression, that even for severe levels of depression, it be combined with psychotherapy and other non-biological approaches. Unfortunately, antidepressants continue to be prescribed at increasing numbers and most often off-label. They're not most of the, about, I want to give you an accurate figure, the recent data that I have seen would suggest that about half of the people who are prescribed antidepressants are not depressed and never had been clinically depressed. It gets prescribed for a number of different disorders. Off-label, it gets even prescribed for insomnia, and insomnia is a side effect of most popularly prescribed antidepressants. It's been prescribed for sexual dysfunction, which is another side effect. The rate of sexual dysfunction with most SSRIs is around 75%, and that's treatment-emergent sexual dysfunction, sexual dysfunction that was not there before the person was put on the antidepressant, and that you don't see in the placebo arm of the trial. And yet you have some physicians, and not just psychiatrists, because some physicians who are not psychiatrists even just give it out like candy, and they will prescribe it for things like insomnia and sexual dysfunction and other conditions for which there is no evidence of efficacy.
Wow. Well, this is just an enormous amount of information. Are you doing a new, have you gone to do a new study yet? Are you in the middle of anything new on antidepressants, or have you decided, hey, I've done everything I can?
Oh, I'm always in the middle of something. There's a study that was done by a fellow who at that time was a graduate student at Wayne State University. He just got, Mike Sugarman is his name, he just got his doctoral degree. And he was at a talk that I gave in Detroit, which is where Wayne State University is, and asked a question that many people used to ask me, would say, well, antidepressants are also prescribed to people for anxiety disorders. Do they work any better for anxiety disorders than they do for depression? And my answer at that time was, well, I'd rather not say, and I'd rather not say because I have peeked at some of the data on that, but haven't done the kind of careful analysis that my colleagues and I did in our meta-analysis of the FDA data, and so I don't want to say something unless I feel I can say it with confidence with, that is based on solid data. And what Mike did was then to do a meta-analysis in which I participated. We used the data from on paroxetine, which is produced by Glasgow Smith Klein, and the reason we did that was that Glasgow Smith Klein is what they were sued at one point in the state of New York for with the charge being that they had hidden the data on the inefficacy of paroxetine for the treatment of depression in adolescence. And as part of the settlement of the suit, they agreed to put the data from all of their clinical trials online, to make them available online. So that meant that with that particular SSRI, paroxetine SSRI, one of the most widely, the type of antidepressants that's most widely prescribed and is SSRIs, and this is one brand of SSRIs. That meant that for paroxetine, we had, as we had had for the FDA data, we had the availability of a complete data set, not just the data that were chosen to be published. And so we looked at how well is paroxetine, how does it compare to placebo in the treatment of anxiety, and found, well, same thing we had found with the treatment of depression. The difference was very small. You get improvement in the drug condition, you get improvement in the placebo condition, difference between drug and placebo, very small, not clinically meaningful. And that's been published online in the journal PLOS One. If you want to look it up and see it, simultaneously there was this is an interesting coincidence. There is a research team in Canada led by Eric Turner, and they have published meta-analyses of the FDA data. And their meta-analysis on the treatment of depression came out that the just within a few months after ours did, after our second one did, and their meta-analysis on anxiety disorders came out fairly soon after our analysis of anxiety disorders came out. And there's, again, they used the FDA data set. In both cases, they found the same thing that we found. Same very small difference, and they looked at actually a larger set of clinical trials covering more of the drugs that had been approved by the FDA. Their main thrust was to look at how many of the trials have not been published, how much difference is there when you look at only the published trials compared to the unpublished trials, and even with the published trials, sometimes the way the data are presented in the publications are somewhat different from and more favorable to the drug than the way they were presented to the FDA and to what you see in the FDA files. But for us, it was comforting to know that we had gotten it right. Critics have tried to show that we must be wrong, and they've done it by reanalyzing our data or by doing whole new analyses on different data, and everyone winds up getting basically the same results. No one ever finds a difference of more of even 3 points on the Hamilton scale, and this is a scale in which you can get a 6-point difference just by difference in sleep patterns, with no difference in any other symptom of depression.
One of the I usually ask, I didn't get to ask you this when we talked. At what point in your work did you come across mine? Because, you know, I published Talking Back to Prozac in 94, in which I looked at their studies too and concluded they were worthless and rigged. I spent a lot of time doing something you didn't do, which is, you know, looking more at rigged, and you look more at what did they actually show. If you assume they weren't rigged. When did you find out about my work?
I found about your work later, because first I had no real interest in antidepressants per se, and so I became aware of your very important work later on. I remember, I believe we met at a conference in Texas, as I recall, and by then I knew of you and knew of your work. But at this point, when I was doing these meta-analyses, I did not. And then I started reading more widely on the antidepressant literature, and that came across your work and the work of David Healy and the work of others, and found out, my goodness, why isn't this more widely known?
Yeah,
this is really important. And so, one of the take-home messages for me from your work and other work that I've come across since then is that if you were talking about benign substances that were not doing harm, then you maybe could be a little less worried about the fact that they're not really effective. I mean, after all, they're producing a placebo effect at least, and that's a reasonable effect. And, but then when you look at the potential harm, that's the difference between the benefit and the harm that you have to look at, and that's why I would avoid prescribing antidepressants. It's gotten moved little by little over these years to more and more antidepressant stance from someone who referred clients for prescriptions to someone who would never do that and would caution to try anything else. Try anything else. And I think the data that is most convincing to me on that is that it becomes more and more clear that one of the things that in the long run antidepressants do is increase the risk of relapse, meaning it makes you depressed compared to any other way of overcoming depression, compared to psychotherapy. Best data are around with cognitive behavioral psychotherapy, but also with other forms of psychotherapy, like interpersonal psychotherapy compared to placebo. There's less relapse when you get better on placebo than there is when you get better on an antidepressant. Compared to physical exercise, actually being put on an antidepressant seems to, if you combine it with exercise, when you have exercise, go to an exercise program, people get better. Same degree of improvement that you find with antidepressants. It may be a placebo effect. It may not, but there's a very low relapse rate. As soon as you add an antidepressant, you increase the relapse rate. So in the long term, you're doing harm.
It's the same thing that people have found with the antipsychotic drugs.
Yes, I've seen that, and I've seen that in the literature. I haven't studied it directly, but indeed, I've seen that both in the meta-analytic research literature and an excellent book by Bob Whitaker here in the Boston
yes.
area, Anatomy of an Epidemic, which I would recommend to as reading for anyone interested in this topic.
Yes, absolutely. We have Bob on the show a few times already. Two things occur to me listening to you a little more clearly than maybe in the past. And one is that these results that you've gotten are based, that are so negative, are based on the assumption that the researchers aren't lying to try to make them look better. You're just taking the data as it is. Now, if you add to it that they're lying, cheating, and manipulating, which I've documented in innumerable of my books and was a main theme of talking back to Prozac. For example, in the Prozac studies, the only ones where they could get a marginal effect for FDA approval were the ones where they, against the rules, gave the patients addictive sedatives to calm down all the anxiety the drugs were producing. And then also their manipulation of the placebo issues and many other things that went into that. So imagine if we could, and we can't really do this well, figure in what it would be like if they weren't lying and cheating. I think it would just come out that patients got acutely worse, worse and worse and worse. But all that's clouded by the fact that the studies that are only 4 to 6 weeks or 8 weeks, maybe occasionally a little longer, those studies are all manipulated. Does that make sense to you, that the situation's actually much worse because of that?
Well, it's an interesting question, and here's what I wind up hearing. Defenders of antidepressants acknowledge that there are problems with the way that clinical trials are done, that the researchers are inflating baseline scores, that they are taking in people that shouldn't be taken into the study, that they're doing various things like that. And they will also say, these studies are no good. It's one of the things that Peter Kramer said recently in an article in the New York Times, where he was criticizing my research, the research of others, and was criticizing an article that had been written by Marcia Angell in the New York Review of Books. Marcia Angell was a former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, and she wrote a favorable review of my book and two other books. But here's what they say. They say, look, the data you analyze, the clinical trial data from the drug companies, they don't show the real efficacy of antidepressants because they're all flawed trials. They're done quickly and easily and cheaply and not well. Their conclusion is that that means that antidepressants really do work, even though they say all of the trials are like that. It's as if, Peter, we have to prove that antidepressants don't work, when instead it should be the other way around. The onus is on the proponents of these medications and on right. the manufacturers of them to prove that they do work. If there's something wrong with these trials that were submitted to the FDA, if they're bad trials, then the drugs should never have been approved.
No, they should be now disapproved in retrospect, if they're correct. Taken off the market. All the studies were poor.
If they're all flawed studies, then you can't draw conclusions from it, and you don't know. Maybe they would have gotten better effects. Do some decent studies that show that, or maybe it would have gotten worse effects as you have been maintaining. But that would, if that's right, then there is no positive data for the effects of these drugs.
And I'm not going to ask you to verify this, but I think only if you have an evil and twisted mind would you suggest that when all of the drug companies are manipulating to try to make the drugs look better, it somehow came out worse. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, we just know that all the manipulations are clearly and deeply motivated toward making the drug look better. This brings me to a larger question. Have you thought about taking your experience in this data and as well as all the other data out there, comparing it to the fact, to the studies showing that antidepressant usage keeps going up, and try to raise some issues about whether this is even a scientific problem anymore, since the scientific answers are in, but is simply a political problem and time to look at it, that we have drugs that don't work, and what's the politics of it? Or is that going too far afield for you?
Well, it's not the kind of thing that I do. I try to stick very much to just analyzing the scientific data and report on the findings, and I don't have any axe to grind beyond that. I am sad to see the increase in antidepressant prescription. I'm not entirely surprised by it. There's a great deal of defensiveness involved in it, I think there's some clear reasons for it. And I'll tell you what the reasons are. I do some studies on irritable bowel syndrome, again, looking at the placebo effect. And I work with gastroenterologists in designing the study and studies and analyzing the data and so on. And in those studies, too, we find that the treatments that are currently used for irritable bowel syndrome do not produce much of an effect beyond the placebo effect. Differences are very small, and that's the fact that there is a big placebo response is useful for us in terms of, by us, I'm talking about the program and placebo studies I'm not director of, I'm associate director of. Here's a place where there is a placebo effect, and so it's a convenient place to look at the mechanisms underlying it and so on, what's producing this effect. But I asked one of my colleagues in gastroenterology, I said, look, you seem so open to these data. You accept them, you're not at all defensive about it. It's so different than what I see among my psychiatric colleagues these days, where it's very rare. There are some that would be open like as you are, but relatively few, and yet I don't see any of that defensiveness in anyone in the field. I've even been invited as a keynote speaker in a pediatric gastroenterology conference to talk about the placebo effect. Why is that? Why is there such a difference between the way you guys react to data showing not much of a difference between treatment and placebo for irritable bowel syndrome and the way the psychiatrists react, the majority, when you show them similar data on antidepressants? And the response was, well, Herb, we know that the drugs we have for IBS or irritable bowel syndrome, we know we don't have very good medications for it. They don't work well. What we're getting is mostly a placebo effect, but there are other things we do. We're not basing our livelihood on treatment for irritable bowel syndrome and for these various treatments like probiotics and so on. If you were to tell us that colonoscopies don't work. They don't do any good. We would be as hostile to you as psychiatry is. Psychiatry is, and now I'm going to my own addition to it. When I was an assistant professor and starting out doing psychotherapy back in the late 1970s, my psychiatric colleagues were involved in doing psychotherapy in large numbers. What I've seen over the years is a shift away from doing psychotherapy and only doing antidepressants and other prescriptions, mostly antidepressants, is much more widely prescribed than antipsychotics. So if they're not doing anything else, if they're no longer doing psychotherapy, as I gather most of them are not, then they're, of course, going to be very threatened by this data. It's going to be hard for them to look at it openly. It's going to be hard for them to see how little good and how much potential harm these medications are doing. It hits them in their pocketbook. If they don't have these drugs to prescribe, what do? And it hits them in their pride and what they have done. I don't think they're evil people, but I think that they are in a position where this is hits too hard. I can't say that about the general practitioners who continue to prescribe antidepressants for things that they should not.
Well, Irving, I think the practitioners who prescribe much more just by sheer volume than the psychiatrists, they would take the lead from psychiatry. The American Psychiatric Association came out and said Irving Kirsch's data is correct, and we're not admitting that Peter Bregan was ever correct, but Hirsch's data is correct. We're not going to do the antidepressants anymore. The whole profession would stop, the whole medical, I really do think.
I'm not so sure about that, Peter. I'm not so sure about that, and I'll tell you why. They are prescribing them for things that for which there is no evidence at all. That no one pretends there is any evidence, but they're not recommended for this. It's against best practice guidelines. I remember a fellow whose dog died in a meeting with his GP, a general practitioner, for problems unrelated to it. He mentioned that, and he was immediately offered a prescription of an antidepressant. I've been offered prescription of antidepressants twice, not related to depression at all. I'm very glad I didn't take it. The second time was after I'd done all of this research, and the fellow who was offering it, it was on the basis of just chatting about how many talks I was giving, and I was going back and forth, and I have this two-month period in which I'm giving 14 talks in 6 different countries. It's a little too much. He said, yeah, that is too much. You shouldn't do things. We should cut back on doing things like that. Well, in the meantime, how about a prescription of citalopram? I looked at him incredulously.
Yeah. Well, let me take a minute and just say that I do think there is a difference between psychiatry and medicine. I do personally think it touches on the nature of evil, never mind whether individuals are evil. I think that psychiatry is doing something that's evil. It is taking psychological, social, spiritual issues and making believe they're medical, and then involuntarily treating hundreds of thousands and millions of people over the generations with violent, horrible technologies, shock treatment, lobotomy, going back further in history, other things, dunking people, and so on. See, I think psychiatry starts with a false premise that is hostile to the very understanding of human nature, that we are creatures who live by values, who grow up in families and develop very much in keeping with how we were raised in families. and then have to learn to live in new ways as we grow up and adapt to the world, who are most successful when we have higher values and are the most successful when we love one another and act bravely on that principle. And the psychiatry is antithetical to all of this and to all the most fundamental Western and Judeo-Christian values by being extreme materialism applied to human nature and human life. And that when you do that, when you objectify a human being like that, you basically are going to end up being very destructive to them. Because objectification is not neutral. There isn't a neutral stance on whether we love one another. We either have empathy and understand, or we do a lot of harm. So I think it's a huger, more global problem, and hence the whole history of psychiatry is one of doing things that don't work and that do huge amounts of harm, including the whole state mental hospital. I made this analysis, I think, for anybody who wants to follow it up. I made it most clearly in two places. One is in a paper I wrote on the role of psychiatry in Nazi Germany. I think it's called The Murder of Mental Patients or something close to that, which is available for free on my website. And I also had an updated chapter on it in the War Against Children of Color. I do think something is going on in psychiatry that is different, and that influences medicine, and that medicine also has its own problems. But lastly, Irving Kirsch, I invite you to have your own axe to grind. I invite you in your mature years with me to really say what the implications are of a profession that pays no attention to honesty and honorableness in the face of the incredible kind of work you've done. So I'm going to present that to you and take a breath.
Okay.
No response required.
But I do want to respond a little. I think that the current stance of the psychiatric profession in general, the majority stance, I think they are wrong. I don't think they are evil people. I don't think they are out to intentionally hurt people. I think they are wrong. I think at some point in history, people will look back at this antidepressant era and look at prescribing of psychiatric drugs in the same way that we look at bloodletting now. But the people who were doing bloodletting in the history of medicine, the people who were prescribing all the crazy things that were prescribed in the history of medicine for the treatment of all kinds of disorders, were not being dishonest. I don't think most psychiatrists are dishonest or evil. I do think they are wrong, and I think they are human beings who are prey to the same things that all of us are prey to, and things that will lead us to see things in one particular way rather
than
another.
Would you say that about the German psychiatrists who led the way in the extermination of their entire mental hospital population, that they were just misled but nice, good people? I don't think so. I think the institutions corrupt people. I think psychiatry is so corrupting that it draws dishonest people, and honest people get corrupted because the premises are wrong. The approach to humans are wrong. I think that it's deeper than just mistaken. Now, are individuals evil? That's between them and God. But this institution is so corrupt in its fundamental approach that I don't think, in fact, anybody will look back on the antidepressant era aghast unless psychiatry doesn't exist anymore. Otherwise, they'll just look at it as one of their genuine efforts, along with lobotomy, that they wish they could find a better way to do.
Well, I'm not going to comment about Nazi Germany until I've read your article, and I haven't read the.
Well, there's been a few books about it now, but mostly in Europe.
Okay.
But no, I don't expect you to comment on that. Folks don't know about that.
So I am not going to comment about that. But I've known and seen psychiatrists who are very compassionate human beings who care about people. They used to be involved in psychotherapy in the same way that clinical psychologists are, and have at times taken into account social and psychological perspectives.
Well, I really don't need to defend individual psychiatrists. I'm saying the profession itself, and I don't want an agreement. I just want to lay out what I think, you know, so folks hear the other side. I just think the profession itself and its premises are so off that you either join it because you're corrupt or you become corrupted or you leave. You basically step out and say, I'm not going to participate in the way you do things. But I don't want to press you on that issue. The work you do is just amazing. It's astonishing. To me, it just underscores that even the best of work, the untainted by outrage, like my work is, you know, I'm outraged at what I see going on around me, that even work done wholly from an objective viewpoint that actually had little interest in psychiatry comes out with such an accurate picture, because you're such a good researcher, that this kind of psychiatric treatment doesn't work. And we, of course, we're increasingly finding that in every area. And in the antipsychotic drugs, they do probably even more harm while not working. Do you have parting thoughts? We have just a couple of minutes left. And you can completely separate, and I will, I completely separate you from the comments I just made on this corrupt institution from my viewpoint. Any party comments for psychologists or people joining the field or about yourself and your work?
Yeah, I would say this, and I would say this to colleagues, and I would say this to people out there who are depressed and are trying to figure out what to do with it. I don't want them to leave this conversation and this program with a sense of increased despair. I'm not saying that there aren't treatments that work.
Good
well
ending.
For
what works? What
there
do you
are.
Think
what,
works?
What I think psychotherapy works. And I think certain kinds of psychotherapy at least can combat against relapse of depression, has much better long-term effectiveness than antidepressants do. And it doesn't matter whether the psychotherapy is done by a clinical social worker, a clinical psychologist, or a psychiatrist. That does seem to work.
Irving, this is the perfect ending. We have to end, but this is the perfect ending. I'm so glad you interrupted and brought it to this ending. May I have you back to talk about psychotherapy research?
Sure.
Great. Irving Kirsch, K-I-R-S-C-H, a marvelous researcher, a good man. You can find him on the internet. Thank you, Irving, so much.